It's the morning show. I'm John Munson. We assume that if a doctor is going to implant something in our body, that it's been scientifically tested and proved to be safe. We also assume that the healthcare system is regulated and focused on keeping us healthy and safe, but as we'll learn this hour, that isn't necessarily true. Over the last 50 or 60 years, we've seen the growth of what my guest calls the medical-industrial complex, organized to produce profit and not always the best patient outcomes. Do you have a medical device implanted? Has it benefited you, or have you had trouble with it? Have you or a loved one had to have a device removed because of a recall? Would you like to see increased regulations in the medical device implant industry, or do you think things are working just fine? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest this hour is Jeannie Lenzer, a medical investigative journalist and longtime contributor to the British Medical Journal. Her work has also appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, and The New Republic. She is the author of a book titled The Danger Within Us: America's Untested, Unregulated Medical Device Industry and One Man's Battle to Survive It. Jeannie Lenzer, welcome to the morning show. Thanks for being with us today.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Your book weaves the story of Dennis Fagan throughout. Dennis spent years battling the after effects of a near-death experience linked to an implanted medical device. How did you and Dennis Fagan meet?
Well, while I was writing for the BMJ, formerly the British Medical Journal, he reached out to many, many people, to regulators, the FDA, the manufacturer, and to many journalists. And I was one of the journalists he reached out to. And I responded and asked him for his medical records and a bunch of other information before I would go forward and look at his case.
And, you know, his story and the way you tell it, I mean, it reads like a modern detective novel. I mean, there's a lot going on here. What was the role, what medical device did Dennis have, and what role did that play in his life?
He had a device called a vagus nerve stimulator, and it's a sort of matchbox-sized device that's implanted, just like a pacemaker, under the clavicle, and then they tunnel some wires up through the under the clavicle to the neck and wrap those wires around the vagus nerve. But I like what you said about it being like a mystery, because doctors, and I was a clinical provider before. I was a PA, and I provided primary care both in family practice and in emergency departments. And we were misled by our own illusions. So the mystery is not just what happens to Dennis Fagan. The mystery is how, as doctors and clinical providers and patients alike, we suffer from these illusions about what's going on. And what was fascinating about Dennis, I'll tell you a little story, a little vignette of what happened to him. So, you know, this all began one night when he was in his 40s, and he was awakened by a pain in his throat. And he knew that that would mean the onset of a seizure. So he got up and put a mark down on his calendar, which he kept for his neurologist. And the neurologist used that to help adjust his medicines based on how many seizures he was having. Well, by the time his parents found him the next morning, there were 12 marks on that date. And as his parents let themselves into his house, Dennis emerged from his bedroom looking dazed, and he immediately lost consciousness and fell to the ground. When he came to, he got up, sat down on a dining room chair, and before his parents could reach him, he fell face first into the floor again. This time when he woke up, he wiggled himself across the floor, afraid that he'd fall again, and just propped himself up against a wall with his back to the wall, his legs splayed in front of him. His jeans were wet with urine, and he looked half dead. His parents were terrified and called an ambulance. By the time the ambulance got there, they'd watched him lose consciousness at least 8 more times. And they get him to the emergency department. Now, Dennis thinks he's having seizures. He's marking them down as seizures. His parents figure he's having seizures. His neurologist comes to the hospital, thinks he's having seizures. The emergency doctor thinks he's having seizures, until they all notice something very strange. That is that Dennis's heart is stopping, completely stopping, and it's stopping at precisely 3-minute intervals. They call a cardiologist in, so now there are 3 doctors all standing there staring at Dennis, terrified that he's going to die. I mean, you know, I talked with the ER doctor, and he said he remembered this patient above all patients in his 30 years in practice, in part because he kept trying to keep him alive, and with each seizure, there was vanishing hope of keeping him alive. And turns out that what was happening was this device that had been implanted in Dennis to prevent seizures, instead of stopping his seizures, was stopping his heart. Now, the doctor is realizing that, you know, the interval of the firing of this device that delivers these electrical shocks to his vagus nerve is exactly at 3 minutes. They turn off the device. Takes a while to do this, so Dennis is suffering, you know, some degree of brain damage from all this loss of blood and oxygen to his brain. And when they turn it off, the seizures stop immediately. And they put him in the intensive care unit to recover. And the next day, Dennis learns that this device nearly killed him. And that was the beginning of his battle with Cyberonics, the manufacturer of the device, and with the FDA, state regulators, politicians, anyone he could reach out to.
We'll come back throughout the hour to Dennis's story. It's a fascinating and dare I say terrifying, in some respects, tale. We'll come back to that throughout the hour. So let's talk a little bit about the medical device industry. How did we get to a point where products like the one that was put in to Dennis Fagan find their way into our bodies, regardless of whether they're proven safe and effective? I guess most of us would assume that, well, we have the Food and Drug Administration. Before something gets put on the market, it's supposed to go through clinical trials and be proven safe and effective and all of that. Your book says, nope, that's not what happens. How does a medical device get into common use? What testing does it have to go through before it can be stuck into our bodies?
Well, unfortunately, most devices undergo no testing at all. And this was really a shock to me. I mean, I've been an investigative reporter for years. I was already cynical when I started writing this book, but I never stopped being shocked as I wrote this book, just how bad the situation is. Turns out that medical devices didn't come under the control of the FDA until 1976. And by then, many, many devices were already on the market. Now, I mean, there were already pacemakers, artificial heart valves, all sorts of devices, electrical stimulators. So what they did was the FDA said, okay, we're just going to grandfather everything in that's on the market right now. And then we're going to divide things into new categories. We'll have class 1, 2, and 3 devices. So class 1 is things like the tongue depressors. You don't really need to do a lot of testing for things like that. Class 2 are somewhat more risky things like implanted hips, artificial hips. Class 3 are the more dangerous things like deep brain stimulators, pacemakers, things like that. So, but by grandfathering them in, not only did a lot of devices stay on the market, but they created these other loopholes. And those loopholes are something called a 510K process, where device manufacturers can just say, well, I've got this new device, but it's really a lot like this other device that's already on the market, the other device being a, quote, predicate device. And the situation is so bad that not only does the FDA let these new devices on the market based on the claim of the manufacturer that they're like another device, they even allowed and defended the use of a predicate device that had been withdrawn from the market because it was deemed dangerous. And they let a manufacturer, and this was with pelvic mesh. So it turns out there was a study done that looked at high-risk heart implants. And that study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And it turns out that only 5% of high-risk cardiac implants ever underwent anything even vaguely approaching the kind of testing that's required for drugs. And it wasn't even equal to that required for drugs. It was just something that vaguely approached it. So there's a real lack of testing. And the other thing is, I think people think that the FDA tests these things. The FDA doesn't do any testing itself. It relies on the manufacturer. That's kind of like, you know, if Consumer Reports went to Ford and said, hey, would you let us know if your Pinto's safe?
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable that we allow manufacturers to be the ones to tell us whether their devices are safe or not.
Yeah,
and we already have they have a track record of concealing harms from devices, and it happens all the time. I mean, this is a regular practice where they simply don't report bad outcomes.
Well, anybody with cable or satellite TV has probably seen dozens and dozens of commercials for large law firms that go along the lines of, have you or anyone in your family ever been implanted with fill in the blank? If so, call the blank law firm at this number because you may be entitled to compensation. We've seen a lot of class action lawsuits over these things. It's really gotten to be a big problem. How big is the medical device industry?
Well, I can't say how big they are. I mean, part of the issue is not only how many billions of dollars they sell in their product, but unlike drugs, they involve an entire industry around their devices. So you've got surgeons implanting the devices in hospitals. So now you have hospitals and surgeons who are making a bundle off of this industry. And then you have follow-up, which is typical with a lot of these devices that need to be monitored. So like with a vagus nerve stimulator and some other electrical devices, typically people go back at 6-month intervals, even 3-month intervals for regular testing with fancy equipment. So now you've got other equipment monitoring manufacturers that are involved, as well as the repeat visits to not the implanting surgeon, but perhaps the cardiologist or the neurologist who's monitoring these devices. It's massive, and it's driving a huge problem. The problem in terms of, you know, you said a lot of people, you know, may be suing over some of these devices, and it's true. There have been a lot of problems with these devices, and they're problems that are unique to devices, very different from drugs, that people might want to consider before they have a device implanted. And don't get me wrong, I mean, there are devices that have been truly life-saving and wonderfully beneficial to people, life-transforming. And I think that's part of what agitated me so much as I learned about Dennis's story and many other people, is that it's so hard to tell the difference between devices that are life-transforming in a positive way and devices that have destroyed people's lives. And I've had surgeons tell me, you know, we don't know. We can't test these devices. We rely on the FDA. So if we're told that this is a great device, you know, we implant it. One surgeon told me, you know, they could cut out a piece of curtain and tell us that it's surgical mesh, and we wouldn't know the difference. So most doctors are unaware not only of the makeup of these devices, but of what they do. And that's the illusion I'll sort of circle back to with Dennis. You know, the illusion is that when things go wrong, it must be the underlying disease. So when Dennis was losing consciousness, the assumption, understandably, the assumption is that it's his seizures, his underlying seizure disorder, not that the device is causing the problem. And throughout the book, I document many different instances in which the devices mimic the very problem that the person got the device for. And it's an illusion I call cure is cause. And it's something that I think more and more doctors are waking up to, that our interventions, medical interventions, whether they're drugs or devices, are causing enormous harm. In fact, medical interventions are now the third leading cause of death in the United States.
Wow. That's a very frightening statistic. We're talking with Jeannie Lenzer, medical investigative journalist and longtime contributor to the British Medical Journal. She has a new book. It's called The Danger Within Us, America's Untested, Unregulated Medical Device Industry, and One Man's Battle to Survive It. We'll continue our discussion with Jeannie Lenzer and with you if you choose to join us at 800-642-1234. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Do you have a medical device of some sort implanted in you? Could be something as simple as, well, maybe you had cataract surgery, so you've got an artificial lens in your eye. Maybe you have a cochlear implant. Maybe it's something a little more serious, an artificial heart valve or a pacemaker. Have these devices benefited you? Have they caused problems? Have you or a loved one had to have a device removed because of a recall? Would you like to see better regulation in the medical device implant industry, or do you think things are working just fine? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Jeannie Lenzer. She's the author of a book titled The Danger Within Us, America's Untested, Unregulated Medical Device Industry. And in it, she tells the story of Dennis Fagan, who had a near-death experience with his implant, and we'll come back to that as we continue our conversation. We've got a phone caller. Let's take a call here. Let's go to Tim in Whitewater. Tim, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Oh, nice setup. I actually do have a cataract surgery with lens implant, and it's been wonderful. So from my personal aspect, it's been great. And your guest touched on it at the end. You know, a third of deaths are caused by this. I think there's a bigger issue here. I'm not always sure that regulation solves everything. I think the bigger issue here is that we are a society that can't let, surgery everything all the time, no matter what the age. And I have a brother who just underwent cancer surgery yesterday, and he's 59. So you'll go, all right, well, and I got a mother who's in her 80s. That has had some surgeries, and sometimes I question why are we doing hip and knee replacements for 85-year-olds? We put them under, the anesthesiology makes them, lose their faculties to a certain degree if they recover or not. Some of this is just societal, too. We don't seem to want to let people just pass on, and that isn't just the medical profession. That's us, too.
Okay. Tim, thanks for your perspective. Jeannie Lenzer, what do you think? One of the reasons we have problems is, well, there's just too much of this stuff, and maybe we need to let nature take its course.
I think Tim touches on a couple interesting and important points. And the first is, he said he doesn't know if regulation will solve this. And I think that's an important point to take up, because right now, of course, the administration has pushed forward an agenda to slash regulations. I want to tell you how that affected Dennis and how it affects hundreds of thousands of patients. I already talked about what we call the pre-market testing, that before a device is put on the market, they don't really test it. Well, the idea is that then if it's not well tested before, at least you should test it once it's on the market. And indeed, it turns out that with the vagus nerve stimulator, one of the things Dennis did was to go into the FDA's database to figure out how could they approve this device that could kill people. And he found not only that 800 people had already died implanted with this relatively new device in often very young people, teenagers, children who had seizures, but he found out that the device had only been approved conditionally. And the reason it was approved conditionally, meaning that the manufacturer was asked by the FDA to conduct studies after it was on the market to prove it was safe, the reason for that recommendation was that, and I'm quoting now an exact quote, they were concerned about a, quote, high rate of deaths. So they observed a high rate of deaths among people implanted with this device before they put it on the market and asked the company, don't demand, don't require. This is what they do. They ask the company to conduct studies. So 12 years after it's on the market, I go to the company and say, where are the studies that show that this is safe? And they send me five studies, and I read all five studies very carefully, and it's an interesting thing. They don't report any deaths on any of the studies. It's not that there are no deaths. It's that they fail to report on deaths. So I go to the FDA thinking there must be unpublished data that makes the FDA satisfied that the device is safe, and ask the FDA for their evidence that the device is safe now that it's been on the market for 12 years. And the FDA sends me the exact same five studies. And my reaction is like, did you guys read these studies? So I go back to Cyberonix, the manufacturer, and say, do you have unpublished data? Thinking for sure they failed to publish it because there must have been excess deaths. And their answer to me, I have all of this in writing, and it's in the book, not contradicted. They actually said, we never collected mortality data. Now, this is on a device that was approved conditionally because of a concern about a high rate of death. The company fails to collect data on death, and I go back to the FDA thinking for sure the company's going to get slammed for this, and the FDA says, we didn't ask them to count deaths, we only asked them to characterize death. Now, is anybody's guess how you characterize death if you don't even know if anybody died?
Well, anyway, characterize death, I mean, you're either dead or you're not. I mean, it's kind of a binary solution set.
I mean, I guess what they could say, theoretically, is what's the nature of the death? So, for example, we might know that if you take aspirin, you could have an allergic reaction to it and die, but you might not expect that you're going to, say, develop encephalitis from it. So a new type of death. But if they're not even collecting the data, you can't characterize anything. And yet this is the kind of behavior that's going on. And it's not just the VNS. I mean, I categorize device after device that has had serious problems. And, you know, one of the things that I was mentioning is that there are problems that are unique to devices, very different than drugs, that people might want to be aware of before they agree to it. And, you know, your caller mentioned having a cataract lens implant. Those are some of the most wonderful things that have helped people, and is also true of pacemakers. You know, these have saved a lot of lives. They've transformed lives, made things better. On the other hand, hundreds of thousands of devices have been recalled. Now, these are devices where people not only underwent surgery and therefore underwent a certain degree of risk with the surgery, but they might want to consider that, don't assume that a device is automatically safe just because it's a hunk of metal or something, or plastic, and you think, therefore, oh, it doesn't have drug side effects. That's not true at all. These devices often have side effects. And one example was metal-on-metal hip implants. You think, well, gee, that's pretty safe sounding. But it turns out that hundreds of thousands of these devices have been released and implanted in people, and they were leaking chromium and cobalt. And one orthopedist that I talk about in the book thought he was choosing the best hip implant for himself. And who should know better than an orthopedist who actually specialized in complex hip implants? And he selected this Medtronic ASR hip implant, and it turned out he got poisoned by it, went into early heart failure, it damaged his brain, and when his surgeon opened up his hip, he said it looked like an automotive crankcase full of dirty oil. It was just black.
Ugh.
The other problem is a lot of these devices have become so complex now. They're Wi-Fi enabled, computerized devices that sometimes purposely leak. They elute is the word they use for it. Certain drugs or have biological material implanted in a device. And when they're electrical, you often can't turn them off readily. So one patient implanted with a VNS, a young woman, I think she was about 31, called her sister saying, oh my God, these shocks are hurting me. I'm falling to my knees. They're so painful. And it was a Friday night, and her sister said, well, you should go to the emergency room right away. And the woman said, you know, I can't because the doctors there don't have the equipment to turn it off. Sunday night, they found her dead on the floor.
Oh.
Now, the other problem is when we talk about, you know, devices and monitoring once they're on the market, is that the FDA database, which now holds a couple thousand deaths for VNS patients, it turns out that a study showed that fewer than 1% or 1% of all device adverse events ever make it into the FDA database.
Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that, but even more shocking to me was that the more serious the adverse event, the less likely it was to be reported. That really shocked me. I would have thought, oh, you know, maybe nausea you wouldn't report, but people dying, people going into heart and liver failure, you don't report that. I mean, it's pretty astonishing how bad the situation is. And worse yet, we also don't know the meaning of those reports to the FDA. And the way they could have meaning is if we had two things. One is we don't have a denominator. In other words, we don't know how many devices are in people at any given time. And that's insane because the technology is there to do it. I mean, Walmart knows at any given minute how many heads of lettuce are on its shelf and how many it has to replace to keep their shelves stacked. And yet we have no idea at any given minute how many VNS implants are in people, how many whatever. And the problem is one death in an 86-year-old who's implanted with a hip is one thing. But a couple thousand deaths in younger people implanted with, say, a defibrillator, you know, that's another thing. And we need to know, is it, you know, a couple thousand out of 50,000? Or is it 100 people out of a million? You know, so we need a denominator. We need the FDA to require that these reports are made to them by the manufacturer. The other thing we need is a monitoring system, a genuine monitoring system. And right now, reporting is voluntary. Most reporting is voluntary. So we, and for those for whom it's mandatory, they get a slap on the wrist if they're caught at all. And most of the times they're not caught in non-reporting. So in Europe and Australia and some other countries, they have mandatory registries. And that really helps them. They get warning clues before we get them in the United States.
We have callers who want to join the discussion. Let's take another call here. Heather is with us in Madison. Heather, thanks for joining us on the morning show today.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead.
So I had breast biopsies. And when I had my biopsies, I didn't realize until I was on the table that they were going to implant small titanium metal markers. They're called breast biopsy clips or breast biopsy markers into me as a part of the biopsy. And I was asking about side effects. They told me there were no side effects. And about 6 weeks after the biopsies, I started to develop a great deal of pain and some other mysterious symptoms. And I'll just give you the short version of this story. I ended up developing two autoimmune disorders, and I had to spend months trying to convince the doctors to take these markers out of my body because I didn't need them. I didn't have cancer. And they were just intended to be left in my body indefinitely, and they caused me serious problems.
Heather, thanks for sharing your story with us. Jeannie Lenzer, how common is a story like Heather's?
Well, what's disturbing is that she wasn't told or asked beforehand about this. And that's another problem, is that I've had people tell me that, and I have their medical records to prove it, that they were told one thing and about their implants. In fact, there was a Medtronic executive who was implanted and had no idea really what was being implanted in her. And you know, these kinds of decisions need time. They can't be handed a sheet of paper right before surgery and say, please sign this.
Well,
none
that's what you
agree.
Get, though. If you go in, yeah, even for, like, cataract surgery, yes, you have a consultation with your ophthalmologist, but you get to the hospital on the day of the surgery. It's considered pretty routine, and here's a nurse with a clipboard and a pen. Here, you need to, before we do this, you know, you need to sign these things. It's not quite like getting a mortgage, but there's a lot of paperwork involved, and there's a lot of print that you don't really have time to read. And I think most of us just trust the medical profession, and we just sign where we're supposed to and take the procedure.
You're absolutely right. It's a very disturbing practice. And they're also written in ways that are confusing and difficult for people to suss out. So I think the opportunity to have learned about titanium, does it have effect? The other problem is, are there other substances in these? So, for example, in the metal hips, which I suspect are made of stainless steel, did they tell people that there's chromium and cobalt in them as well? I mean, it's a very difficult problem, and it's also very difficult to put on the shoulders of patients because, as I'm saying, you know, here we have experts like an orthopedic surgeon who can't even get himself a good hip implant, and we've got a Medtronic executive who doesn't have the knowledge to realize what she was being implanted with. We really have to demand, I think, better regulation. And we should insist not on decreasing regulation to get devices out faster. We need more regulation. And in this new era of deregulation that Trump has promised, the slash regulations, what they're saying, they actually encourage, it's in writing, they encourage industry to shift the burden of testing from pre-market to post-market. And this is all in the name of what they call, quote, least burdensome. Well, who is least burdensome for? It's least burdensome for the company's profit. It's shifting the burden from the company to the public. And can you imagine, think about the conditional approval of the VNS device. Conditional because of a high rate of death. Imagine if a future patient was told, about to be implanted, gee, we've got this device. It might help you have fewer seizures. We're not totally sure because some people get more seizures, some people get less. But by the way, you might be more likely to die if you have this. We were concerned about it. So it's only approved conditionally. Would you like to have this implant? I mean, how many people would have agreed to that? But the FDA didn't require the company to tell patients that. And when Dennis Fagan found out, and I asked him, would you have had this implanted if you knew that? Were you desperate enough, do you think, that you would have? He said, hell no. It's just extraordinary what's going on behind the closed doors of the FDA and industry. And in fact, talk about closed doors, the FDA secretly with AdvaMed, the industry trade industry, you know, representative is AdvaMed. I'm losing the words right now, but they met secretly with them to craft this new legislation, 21st Century Cures, to lower the burden of proof.
Well, it doesn't seem likely that the marketing materials for any of these things would be headlined "Some People Survive." You know,
I'm sorry to laugh, but it's just so tragic.
Yeah.
No, you go to the websites and it's all cheery. And in fact, so cheery that there's one part that I tell about some patient groups that are wooed. They're seduced by the company with all sorts of little gifties and attention. And what happened was, though, is people started getting implanted with the device and started having problems, and they had this, the company had a website for patients to ask questions and learn and share with each other. Well, things stopped being so rosy after a number of people got implanted, and it started increasingly seeming like a complaint board. And as soon as the complaints really started ratcheting up, the company just pulled the plug. I mean,
yeah,
it just took the website down.
I can see I can see that happening. We need to get to a break here, Jeannie Lenzer, and we have so much more to talk about. I want to hear more. I want to hear more about Mr. Fagan and what happened with him ultimately, and some of that story. We don't want to give the whole thing away. Or people, you know, we want them to read the book, but I want to hear more about Dennis and what he went through and how that whole thing played out. We're talking with Jeannie Lenzer. She's the author of The Danger Within Us: America's Untested, Unregulated Medical Device Industry and One Man's Battle to Survive It. We have more calls to take and lots of other stuff to do here before the end of the hour. So stick with us. John Munson in for the morning show this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the morning show. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent this week. Jeannie Lenzer is my guest. She's the author of The Danger Within Us, America's Untested, Unregulated Medical Device Industry, and One Man's Battle to Survive Us. 800-642-1234. We've got some calls. I want to be sure to take them. But before we get to that, Jeannie, let's hear more about what happened to Dennis Fagan. I think when we left his story last, he had gone to the FDA and done some research. What did he do ultimately after he got his information? What did he do with that information? How did he, what happened next in his story?
Well, he tried to get help from everybody, and he approached some politicians who would thank him for his, quote, concern, and then they'd immediately put him on their mailing list to raise money with nothing happening. And basically, he just landed up hitting a lot of dead ends and wasn't able to get help for himself. And there's so many twists and turns in his story, and the reason I tell his story is that it really helps illuminate the problem from the conception of devices, the prior approval, the monitoring or lack of monitoring, right up to something that affected Dennis when he couldn't get help from the company, denying what happened. And, oh, there is one other thing that happened that I should mention. The company not only tried to blame a drug rather than their device for this problem, saying that, oh, a medicine that he took might have caused the problem. Now, how a medicine stops your heart at exactly 3-minute intervals when your device happens to be firing is another story. But they actually came to his appointment, follow-up appointment, after he was released from the intensive care unit, and an executive from the company came and asked his neurologist in front of Dennis to turn the device back on. Dennis was, of course, outraged by this. I mean, he said, this is the thing that nearly killed me, and they want it turned back on. It was just extraordinary. But he eventually did approach a lawyer, and he pulls a letter out of his mailbox one day that says, oops, gee whiz, you can't sue. The Supreme Court just passed a ruling saying that if a device has been approved by the FDA, you cannot sue.
Wow.
This does not exist for drugs. You can still sue over drugs, but the device industry is very powerful, and they've lubricated a lot of palms. There's a lot of money flowing in many directions.
Yeah. What about, well, let's take another call here. Bob is with us in Delavan this morning. And Bob, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
I had an atrial septal defect. It was congenital. And, of course, in 1954 when I was born, they didn't have open-heart surgery. So I was told later in life, the doctors kept saying, you know, you have a heart murmur. And I said, yes. And finally, one doctor said, we're going to keep you in the hospital. And I said, why? Because of your heart murmur. And I said, oh, well, I went in, had the operation, and the hole was quite large. And when I awoke in my room after recovery, they had implanted a pacemaker. And I said, I didn't know you were going to put a pacemaker in. They said, well, we had to, and we talked about it before. You probably don't remember because of the anesthesia. I said, well, okay. So 8 years later, I had it replaced, and the doctor that was supposed to replace it said to me in the morning when I was there in the hospital, I'm going to let this other doctor do it because I have to go. And he said, okay, fine. You know, you trust your doctors. And for the next 4 months, I complained that there was something wrong with the the new pacemaker. I said it felt the site felt hot to the touch, and it was red. And he kept asking me if I was picking at it or something, and I said no. And finally, after 4 months, I talked to my GP, and I went and saw him. And by then, the wire had eroded through my chest. And there was an infection about an inch and a half from my heart, and I had to spend 7 days up at St. Luke's where they took the old pacemaker out and waited another 4 more days to put the new pacemaker in on the opposite side.
Oh, my goodness. I am so sorry to hear about that story, and unfortunately, it's a far more common story than people realize. I'll give one example, again, of why we need more, not less, regulation. There's Sprint Fidelis lead wires that go to defibrillators. These are the wires that are planted into the heart. Part of this approval based on the idea, or clearance by FDA, based on the idea that there's something already on the market like it. What they did is the company filed a supplement. They changed the lead wires to make them slightly thinner. And so, therefore, they didn't have to undergo clinical testing. You just put it on the market. And the problem is they were subject to fracture. And this caused horrific agony to people who would get repeatedly defibrillation shocks. And as John Mandrola, a cardiologist, said, you may survive the first shock just having pain. You're conscious. But to have the third, fourth, and fifth shock, shock progresses to terror. And the problem is you can't just pull these lead wires out, and you've got to get to the ER, get it turned off. In that time, you suffered a lot of harm. But the other problem is lead wires do tend to erode of all sorts, and this affected dentists. It affects many people, and they get enmeshed. Because they erode, they trigger inflammation, and the inflammation causes scarring, and it can be very difficult, even dangerous, to remove these wires. And a study was done and found that of the hundreds of thousands of patients with various lead wires, and there were, I think, like 95 or 98,000 recalled just from Sprint Fidelis, there was a 15 to 18% serious adverse event rate when they removed the wires. So these are things that people, you know, if you don't need some and the problem isn't really severe, you really want to think twice about having some of these implants.
Bob,
and
thanks.
You want to know their track record. I'm sorry.
Bob, thanks for your call. I want to get another call in here because this is, I think, an important call to take. Well, they're all important. This one is very timely. Raymond is with us in Milwaukee. Raymond, go ahead.
I have a VNS. I was heading towards static epileptics. My seizures were getting progressively worse, multiple a day. No medication was controlling it. They gave me the VNS. It took 3 surgeries because the leads broke twice. But now I'm functioning, I'm healthy, and I'm in a PhD program in mathematics.
That's fantastic.
That made a huge difference for me.
That's really fantastic. Yep. So you're having a lot fewer seizures now, is what you're saying?
I have almost none.
Wow. And would you mind telling me how old you are?
I'm in my 40s.
Mm-hmm. And you had this implanted when you were how old?
It was 2006, so.
About 11 years ago. So you were in your 30s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Raymond, thanks for sharing your story with us. I guess that call was timely. Jeannie, you're not saying that all of these devices are inherently bad, just that we don't know enough about them.
No, I think, you know, here's where it gets very iffy and difficult, because some devices probably should never have been approved. And the VNS is a real iffy one. And I think if people, you know, there are two things, and why I ask his age is that one of the many illusions about devices is not only that what we observe, we think always is from their underlying disease rather than the device, but many people get better on their own, and even people with status epilepticus have gotten better. In fact, in studies in countries where they don't always keep people on medicine, about a third of patients have their seizures simply disappear. And I'm not talking about febrile seizures of children. We're excluding those. There are people who have genuinely been diagnosed with epilepsy, and they just go away. And they happen to have had an implant or a drug, so we think, oh, gee, that's what cured them. And they're the ones who will call in and tell us about these stories. And they did genuinely get better. Now, how to know whether they got better from the device or drug can be difficult on any individual basis. So the only thing we have is scientific studies to look at and see, are you more likely to die or not? Now, I respect the fact that some people are so harmed by their underlying disease, they're willing to take more risk, and that's understandable. But then I think you have to honestly appraise people of what those potential harms are. That's all mm-hmm. I'm asking, that people know so they can make it an honest decision. And right now they're deprived of that information. So I think people with milder seizures or who would want to know about these stories would say, I don't want to take that risk.
We're just about out of time, Jeannie, but one of the points you make in your book that I wanted to bring up here is that you talk about this as one more symptom of the overall problem we have in the United States with the way we deliver health care and the outcomes that we get here compared to what they have in other countries.
Absolutely. We've left everything to profit motive, and that's not the right motive to deliver health care. There's only one concern that a healthcare provider should have when facing a patient, and that is what's best for that patient. And right now, there's far too much money contaminating that picture. When doctors are making literally tens of millions of dollars in some instances for implanting these devices, that's dangerous.
So, the Hippocratic Oath is first do no harm. I mean, that's something that doctors are supposed to learn in medical school.
Well, I think we're all pretty good at convincing ourselves of decent reasons why we do things. And so I imagine that doctors who implant these devices convince themselves that they're doing God's work. But we all know how bias works. Bias isn't something that we're conscious of. It's something that affects what we do. Because we get some benefit from it. And what I want to see is doctors being salaried, just like firefighters who risk their lives to save people, police officers. Doctors should be salaried, and they shouldn't be getting more money for doing more, nor should they get more money for doing less. So what we want is only one concern: what's best for that patient.
Quickly, about 30 seconds left here, what advice would you offer a patient who needs some kind of medical device implant?
Get active, but also get online. And as bad as the internet is, see if you can find other patient groups that are not funded by industry and learn what they're saying about the device.
Do your homework. Good advice for all of us. Jeannie Lenzer, thank you so much for sharing this hour with us. Very informative.
Thank you very much.
Jeannie Lenzer is a medical investigative journalist and author of The Danger Within Us, America's Untested, Unregulated Medical Device Industry, and One Man's Battle to Survive It. She is a journalist and longtime contributor to the British Medical Journal. Her work has also appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, and The New Republic. The Morning Show is produced by Brianne Chasso and Niaja Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer and also helped out with technical direction along with Rachel Vasquez today. Appreciate all of them helping get this thing on the air. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. See you tomorrow.